Radio Derb is on the air. This is your radiantly genial host, John Derbyshire, with news from all over. Let's start in the world's greatest deliberative body. Two weeks ago, Radio Derb reported on the crisis over the 2011 budget, now in its sixth month. Just to remind you, Congress was supposed to pass a budget to fund federal government operations for the 2011 fiscal year, which runs from last October to this coming September. The Democrat-controlled Congress, with a Democrat in the White House, should have had no difficulty passing a budget by last October 1st, but they thought other things were more important. For example, ramming the president's preposterous and unconstitutional health care bill down the nation's throat. Then came the midterm elections, and the House flipped Republican. And what Congress might have done easily a few weeks earlier, it now had no hope of doing on Democrats' terms. So our federal legislators never did get a budget passed. Federal operations are being funded by stopgap resolutions, each one basically saying, let's just go on spending for a couple more weeks on last year's plan, with some slight modifications here and here. Well, in our March 4th broadcast, we reported on that week's stopgap resolution, the fifth in this ongoing non-budget crisis. It was only good for 2 weeks, though. It ceased to have any force in law at the stroke of midnight tonight, Friday, March 18th. A sixth resolution was needed, so on Tuesday this week the House of Representatives passed one. The resolution was then passed by the Senate on Thursday. There are a number of things to be said about this, starting with, this is a hell of a way for the world's most advanced, most powerful nation to finance its governmental affairs. The most important thing that needs to be said, though, is that Congress is playing pinochle in the lounge of a sinking ship. Our national debt is $14.3 trillion, a staggering sum of money, close to $50,000 for every man, woman, and child of us. The national debt is not a fiction or an abstraction. It's money we have borrowed on which we're obliged to pay interest. Tuesday's continuing resolution cut $6 billion from spending for the period it covers, which is the next 3 weeks. Here's CNS News putting that in context. Quote, if Congress were to cut $6 billion every 3 weeks for the next 36 weeks, it would manage to save, between now and late November, as much money as the Treasury added to the nation's net debt during just the business hours of Tuesday, March 15th. End quote. And that's right. The national debt increased by $72 billion just on Tuesday this week. And Congress plays pinochle. And even these picayune cuts don't touch the fast-expanding entitlement programs. The watertight compartments are filling up one by one, and Congress is essentially doing nothing. Continuing resolution is a nice phrase. If you look up the word resolution in your Webster's dictionary, you get this meaning, which is the one intended. A declaration submitted to an assembly for adoption. You also get some other meanings, though, including this one. Settled determination, firmness or constancy of resolve. In that second meaning, what we're seeing in Congress this week is continuing irresolution. That's Congress, as in both the Republican-controlled House and the Democrat-controlled Senate. It's true, 54 House Republicans balked at Tuesday's resolution, but the silly thing passed anyway. John Two-Hanky Boehner is there at the Pinochle table, along with most of his Republican colleagues. And of course, while most congressional Republicans are reluctant to face reality, the people over on the political left don't even know that there is such a thing as reality. Here was Senator Chuck Schumer, a leader of the congressional faction that thinks the federal government spends far too little. Boehner had to rely on House Democrats to get this latest resolution through, says Schumer correctly, posting on the congressional blog. But why? Here's Chuck's explanation. Quote, "The reason was conservative Republicans abandoned their party leadership in droves out of anger that the measure lacked special interest add-ons dealing with ideological issues like abortion, net neutrality, and global warming." End quote. Special interest add-ons. How sly is that? The whole argument of those dissenting Republicans is that the government needs to spend less. Chuck manages to make it sound like they're adding on some new spending. We have a master propagandist here. Here's another quote from Chuck. The guy's really priceless. Quote, "Outside forces on the far right are also cheerleading a shutdown. Tea Party Nation, for example, has called on Republicans to oppose any more budget measures unless they repeal health care and do away with family planning." End quote. You see, those heartless people on the far right want to end health care in America and make family planning a thing of the past. Look, I don't mind a little exaggeration for polemical effect, but really, Senator. This is the tone of the debate as the debt swells and the economy sputters. $14.3 trillion. A $72 billion increase just last Tuesday. Oh, and our Treasury Secretary, 14-year-old Timmy Geithner, says we need to borrow more or else the roof will fall in. How did things get this bad? How did the management of this nation's affairs attain such altitudes of stupidity and irresponsibility? The answer, in a word, is democracy. Here's a Washington Post ABC News poll reported in the Post last Tuesday. Highlights. On the question of finding the right balance between slashing unneeded government spending and continuing essential functions, 43% side with the president, 42% with the GOP. Here's another one. While 41% of Americans say big cuts in federal spending are likely to spur job growth, about as many, 45%, say that such a move is more apt to result in job losses. Another one. When it comes to dealing with the economy, Obama has an advantage. 46% say they put more faith in the president. 34% say so about congressional Republicans. Another one. Obama has a 12-point lead on the question of who better understands the economic problems people face. And one more. The president has a 9-point edge on dealing with the deficit. That's this week's Washington Post ABC News poll. Well, here's the second president of the United States, John Adams. Quote, "Democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. There is never a democracy that did not commit suicide." End quote. I think he nailed it. $14.3 trillion, $50,000 a head. That's $200,000 for my little household here. and Chuck Schumer's bleating about the end of family planning. Cry the beloved country. The Congress critters have been able to get away with their pinocling more easily than they might have otherwise because of the awful news from Japan all over our newspaper front pages this week. At this end of the week, the news is mostly about the 6 nuclear reactors at the Fukushima Daiichi complex. All the reactors survived the earthquake unharmed, as they were designed to. Their emergency cooling systems likewise survived intact. The highly radioactive fuel in a reactor gets very hot and it needs constant cooling, even when no electricity generation is going on. Pumps powered by electricity provide the cooling. If electricity fails, backup diesel generators kick in to keep the cooling systems going. And that's what happened. It all worked fine. Then came the tsunami. It knocked out those backup generators, so now there was no cooling. This was really bad design. As a physicist friend of mine remarked, quote, "You can watch all the short movies of the tsunami and its consequences and see for yourself that simple three-story concrete buildings withstood the wave. Only one-story buildings were washed away. Now, you're building your nuclear plant just 300 feet from the physical shoreline, and you are doing it in the country whose language is the source of the word tsunami. Could you show just a little bit of caution and put your diesels on a 3-story concrete pedestal?" End quote. That simple precaution was not taken, and the result followed. Well, that's water under the bridge, or in this case, over the backup diesel power generators. What's the prognosis here? What can we expect? Obviously, one thing we can expect is a lot of hysteria. We live in a hysterical age. The Speaker of the House of Representatives weeps copiously when recalling his perfectly unremarkable lower-middle-class upbringing. Another Congress sissy, this one a Muslim, weeps when speaking of insults offered to a co-religionist. Insults which, it turned out, were a figment of the weeper's overheated imagination. Public sector workers in Wisconsin, faced with some slight trimming of the power and privileges they should never have been granted in the first place, scream that ruthless capitalist hyenas are stomping on their inalienable rights, do their best to shut down the state legislature, post gruesome death threats to lawmakers, and in one case, screech, "You're dead!" at political opponents across the floor of the legislative chamber. People have lost all sense of proportion. Making a pass at a girl is now sexual harassment, an actual crime in many jurisdictions. Minor acts of rudeness are now considered evidences of a desire to commit mass murder or reintroduce slavery. Not wanting your son taken on a camping trip into the woods by a homosexual scoutmaster is proof that you are an evil person whose soul is dark with moral turpitude, and so on. As I said, it's a hysterical age, a feminized age, ruled by snarling aggressive women and whimpering girly men. So I guess it's not surprising that reaction to Japan's nuclear plant crisis has been hysterical. Tokyo will have to be evacuated. A great plume of radioactive dust is crossing the Pacific. Flee, flee, take to the hills. America's stock of iodine pills has sold out. Makers of hazmat suits are doing brisk business. Is this the end of the world? No, but a lot of people think they can see it from here. for crying out loud. The worst-case scenario anyone has so far been able to come up with from Fukushima is that there will be a meltdown at one or more of the reactors, destroying the containment vessel. That, please remember, is the total worst case, which can likely be averted. What happens then? Well, a plume of radioactive steam and smoke goes up to around 1,500 feet into the air for the first few hours, or at worst days, that it takes to control the fire. Is that bad? It's way bad, but only for the immediate neighbourhood, maximum 20 miles in whichever direction the wind is blowing. You wouldn't want to be eating any lettuce grown under that 20-mile plume. Tokyo? That's 150 miles away. Los Angeles? 5,500. In fact, even that may be overstating things. At Chernobyl, which was a far worse situation, the fire burned not for hours, but for months. The debris went not 1,500 feet into the air, but 30,000 feet. Even so, there is no evidence that anyone more than 20 miles away came to any harm, other than by eating contaminated food, which was a dumb thing to do. Here's a pop quiz. What was the death toll from Chernobyl, which was a far worse disaster than anything we can expect at Fukushima, remember? What was it? Well, 31 people died when Chernobyl blew. 134 people got injurious doses of radiation, and some of those people have died in the quarter century since, although many from causes not related to radiation. Wikipedia lists 60 known deaths from the explosion and radiation overdoses. However, UNSCEAR, that's the United Nations Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation, UNSCEAR gives the number of dead as 57. Estimates of the number who may eventually die from cancers triggered by lower radiation doses are all over the place. UNSCEAR claimed 4,000 cases of thyroid cancer up to 2002, but this number is widely disputed, and thyroid cancer is anyway preventable with iodine supplements. Even if you get thyroid cancer, it's highly treatable, with 5-year survival rates 85% for females and 74% for males. And again, the peril there was from contaminated food and water, which people ought to have been prevented from ingesting. So, if you're having nightmares about Los Angelinos glowing in the dark, forget it. The last estimate that I've seen for deaths from the earthquake and the tsunami was nudging 15,000, and it'll probably go higher. Chernobyl, a far worse disaster than Fukushima is likely to be, most probably killed less than 5% of that number, perhaps less than 2%. Japan has suffered a terrible catastrophe, but Fukushima is only a footnote. So please calm down and stop screaming. Last year, 269 people were killed in traffic accidents on the streets of New York City. It's unlikely in the extreme that Fukushima will kill that many Japanese. It's an order of magnitude more unlikely that it will cause even a single American to lose a day off work. So calm down, for goodness sake. If you want a model for grace under extraordinary pressure of distress, you could hardly do better than the average Japanese citizen. The people of Japan have behaved themselves with great dignity and civility, to general admiration. This is something that would have surprised our forefathers. The early 20th century Japanese were not noted for ruliness. Hundreds died in the Rice Riots of 1918, and there was massive destruction of property. That's Rice Riots, not Race Riots. Though there were race riots too. The great earthquake of 1923 was followed by widespread disorder, including the massacre of over 6,000 Korean residents. Pre-war Japanese politics was very brutal. The system, as it was in the 1930s, has been described by one historian as government by assassination. And of course, the Japanese treatment of prisoners of war and occupied peoples is notorious. So, when and how did the Japanese get so well behaved? The 1945 defeat surely helped. A really big defeat can have much civilizing effect. After the Battle of Lechfeld in AD 955, the Magyars stopped being a wild Asiatic horde and turned themselves into the Christian Kingdom of Hungary, in the space of a single generation. It's almost as if, having given war their best shot and failed, a nation collectively decides to walk a different path. Modernity has something to do with it too. In the pre-modern period, when folk didn't travel much or interact with foreigners, every people on earth thought themselves special, and they thought the rest were just a comical rabble with weird customs, speaking gobbledygook languages. For island nations, the effect was magnified. Here's the Italian historian Paolo Giovio describing the English of the mid-16th century. Quote, "The English are commonly destitute of good breeding and are despisers of foreigners, since they esteem him a wretched being and but half a man who may be born elsewhere than in Britain." End quote. Yep, that's how I was brought up. "The wogs begin at Calais," we used to snigger to ourselves. I think the Japanese were even worse. In a globalized world of mass media and easy travel, those attitudes are not tenable. Being rude to foreigners is no longer an option. You're just encountering too many of them, on your TV screen, if not in person. You become aware that your nation is just one among many, some of them richer and more powerful than yours. It's humbling and leveling. It makes for a turn of attitude. There's more than one direction you might turn in. In the West, we've embraced xenophilia and multiculturalism, even setting other cultures above our own in moral worth. The Japanese turned in a different direction, inwards, to the quietly prideful, self-sufficient ethno-nationalism that we see today. "We don't mind foreigners or look down on them," they say, "but they have their own countries and we have ours." This attitude has its downside, mainly the collapsing demographics of Japan, which they could easily alleviate by admitting a couple of million Indonesians for settlement every year. They'd rather not do that. They'll take the downside because they like the upside, which is great social cohesion and a sense of the nation as a huge extended family. Which, genetically speaking, it is. And that's what you see in the orderliness and self-discipline following this disaster. They're not looting for the same reason you don't steal from your brother. I don't say that's the entire explanation. A population isolated and inbreeding for 100 generations or more will develop distinctive frequencies of personality and behaviour and intelligence traits. The short way of saying that is that the Japanese behave like this nowadays because they're Japanese and this is now. I have a private suspicion that Japan will come back from this dreadful catastrophe stronger than before, perhaps even turning around their demographic decline. We'll see. In the meantime, let's wish them luck and help them as each of us feels moved to do. All right, Libya. I know, I've been a bit flippant about Libya. When I see Middle East Muslims at war with each other, my default attitude is the one voiced by Henry Kissinger during the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s. Quote, "It's a pity both sides can't lose." I'm therefore totally on board with President Obama's Taoist approach to the situation. That is, watch for inaction. In the matter of Libya, no policy is the right policy. It would be immensely satisfying to see Gaddafi swinging from a lamppost, but from the point of view of cold statecraft, there's a case for Gaddafi. As David Frum pointed out in an excellent article in Wednesday's Daily Telegraph, long quote, "Perhaps President Obama reasoned something along these lines. Yes, Gaddafi is a very bad guy. But he quit the terrorism business a decade ago and paid compensation to the families of victims of the Lockerbie bombing. He surrendered his nuclear program in 2003. He cooperates with the EU in stopping illegal immigration into Italy. He's a reliable oil supplier and a good customer for Western companies. It's very sad to see Gaddafi crush an uprising so brutally. But things could be worse. Tribal leaders fighting each other, inspired by Islamic ideology, all just 300 miles from the coast of Sicily. We could have 300,000 refugees showing up on the NATO side of the Mediterranean. Better stick with the devil we know." End long quote. It's true, as David also observes, that Gaddafi will be gone someday, and there's no knowing what we'll get in his place, except that it surely won't be Jeffersonian democracy. But then there's no knowing what we'll get if he loses in this fighting, with the same negative exception. It's the devil we know for a few more years, followed by unknowns, versus unknowns next week. That's really not much of a choice, but a slight preference for Gaddafi winning is understandable. In any case, anything we tried to do would most probably leave the Middle East Muslims hating us even more than they do. Taoism is right, and the commentators bleating that Obama should be more proactive are wrong. Just for once? Go ahead, say it, Derb. Just for once, I'm with Obama here. As if we needed a reminder that we're dealing with a region of highly doubtful collective sanity, here came some Palestinian terrorists to remind us. Last Friday night, two Palestinian terrorists broke into the home where Rabbi Udi Fogel lived with his wife Ruth and their six children. Rabbi Fogel was asleep with the couple's three-month-old baby, Hadas. The intruders cut the rabbi's throat and decapitated the baby. Ruth Fogel was in the bathroom. When she came out, the two terrorists stabbed her and killed her. Then they stabbed to death two of the Fogel's sons, 11-year-old Yoav and 4-year-old Elad, in their beds. Two other children, an 8-year-old and a 2-year-old toddler, were in a different room the killers missed. The Fogel's 12-year-old daughter was visiting at a friend's house. When she came home 2 hours later, she found the 2-year-old toddler standing over the bloody corpses of his parents, calling for them to wake up. Among Palestinian militants, this was considered a heroic operation. Hamas operatives in the Gaza Strip were handing out free candy to passers-by, by way of celebration. Nice. Reaction from other Palestinian Arabs has been mixed. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas condemned the massacre, saying on Israel radio that it was, quote, a despicable, immoral and inhuman act. That may, of course, not be what he's saying to his own people, given that Abbas is a duplicitous son of a bitch with a shaky political base. But it's better than nothing. Other Palestinians went into denial, saying it was a robbery gone wrong, or a Mossad operation. Nobody has yet blamed the USA. But it's only been a week. Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Malki got the Chutzpah Award for the following remark, quote, "No Palestinian has ever murdered an infant or civilians in such a manner, either for nationalist causes or in revenge, which raises doubts regarding Israel's haste to accuse the Palestinians." End quote. Let's just meditate on that for a moment. No Palestinian has ever murdered an infant or civilians in such a manner. That is so far from reality, you have to wonder what Hamas is putting in that celebration candy. Continuing our coverage of Europe's nightmare, a flood of refugees and economic migrants from that huge, poor, overpopulated continent on the south side of the Mediterranean. I've mentioned the Italian island of Lampedusa, between Sicily and Tunisia. More than 9,000 refugees have arrived on Lampedusa in the past 2 months. Well, 100 miles east of Lampedusa is the island nation of Malta. 500,000 people on a territory 1/10 the size of Rhode Island. Malta's been getting refugees too. 26,000 in the last month. More than half of Malta's entire military budget goes to food and shelter for refugees. And still they're coming. Malta and Italy are the most worried countries so far, but France and Germany are waking up to the problem. A prominent member of Nicolas Sarkozy's party said the refugees should be, quote, put back on their boats. She had to apologise for that, but the fact that a respectable representative of the ruling party would say such a thing tells its own story. Down at the less respectable end of French politics, Marine Le Pen, leader of the Nationalist Protectionist Immigration Restrictionist National Front, paid a 3-hour visit to Lampedusa. Interviewed in Rome afterwards, she said, quote, "They cannot be allowed on the shore. Send boats out to feed them, but they must not set foot on land." End quote. Yet another European lady, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, asked on Tuesday this week about the refugees, said that, quote, "We are ready to help in economic terms, but I don't see the future in having us expand legal immigration." This will get worse before it gets better, if it ever does get better. Jean Raspe's 1973 novel, Camp of the Saints, about an invasion of Europe by Third World refugees, is back on the bestseller lists in France. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Item: Italians took time off from worrying about the refugee issue to celebrate their nation's 150th birthday. Radio Derb is glad to celebrate with them. Italy has contributed more to human civilization in this 150 years than the whole of North Africa has in 10 times as many years. So thanks, guys. Next up, 10 years ahead, Germany, which was formally united as a nation in 1871. By way of preparing for that, I recommend Peter Watson's excellent new book, The German Genius. Item: Here's one that got my blood boiling. You know about La Raza, of course. La Raza means the race, and it's the name of the USA's biggest lobbying organization on behalf of open borders and Mexican colonization of our Southwest. Where do you think La Raza, the race, where do you think they get their money from? Well, they get some of it from you and me. The conservative newspaper Human Events has been scrutinizing La Raza's tax returns. In 2006 and 2007, they were getting $3.5 million in grants each year from the government. By that point, the Bush administration was so pleased with La Raza's efforts, they raised the grants to over $5 million. So next time you see one of those mass demonstrations for amnesty, with a sea of Mexican flags filling your TV screen, take pride in seeing your tax dollars at work. Item: viral video clip of the week was undoubtedly UCLA third-year political scientist student Alexandra Wallace letting loose on the bad manners of Asian students, talking on their cell phones in the library, for instance.
In America, we do not talk on our cell phones in the library. Where? Every 5 minutes, I will be, okay, not 5 minutes, say like 15 minutes. I'll be like deep into my studying, into my political science theories and arguments and all that stuff, getting it all down, like typing away furiously, blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden, when I'm about to like reach an epiphany, over here from somewhere, oh, Ching Chong Ling Long Ting Tong. Oh. Are you freaking kidding me? In the middle of finals week.
This fired off one of those stupid, stylized public dramas we're all so wearily used to. Weeping victims of the outrage step up to display their wounds and demand justice. More militant types call in death threats. Ms. Wallace is, I believe, now under police protection. Minor officials, in this case, spokescritters for the UCLA administration, honk moral disapproval, using all the threadbare vocabulary of bogus indignation. Hurtful, repugnant, abhorrent, and all the rest. And at last the offender does a full public recantation, grovelling and begging for forgiveness at the altar of political correctness. I'd assume Eric Holder's Justice Department is readying a full investigation, so Ms. Wallace can look forward to a couple of years giving depositions. Meanwhile, I, being known to have some acquaintance with Oriental languages, I am getting asked what it was that the buxom Miss Wallace said there. Well, her pronunciation was terrible, so it's hard to be sure, but it sounded to me like the Chinese for, "They're real, I swear." Item: just a request here. It was a year ago now that Lee Jin-gyu of South Korea won our hearts by marrying his pillow. This was a huggable body pillow with the face of an anime character painted on it. If you've seen that great Craig Gillespie movie, Lars and the Real Girl, you know the zone we're in here. Well, what I want to know is, how are the newlyweds getting on 1 year later? I can't find anything on the news websites. If anyone can update me, please send an email to the address you see at johndarbyshire.com. That's it, folks. The Japanese are stoical, the Palestinians are homicidal, California girls are bold and bodacious, and Congress critters are fiddling while our national finances burn. All quite normal, really.